Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 24th, 2005, and today's session is Confronting Racism, Doing Our Own Work, presented by Jane Ralph, the Holden Outreach Coordinator, in the Fireside Room, disc number FO2005-17.
Say Nancy says something that is from her heart and very well-intended, but it twinges me a little bit. It's my responsibility to say ouch, if I choose to, and to raise it up. It doesn't derail the whole conversation to my pain for the rest of the session, but it's a chance to register it, register an ouch. I can name what it was or not, that's my choice, but at least to name that something happened. It may be an opportunity for me to approach Nancy later if I don't want to deal with it in the group, but for, you know, just it's a chance to register it, because the impact is just as valid as the intent. So there's a balance between those two. One of the things that I think makes these things work is the idea of taking personal responsibility. For what we say, what we don't say, and that basically we get to choose. And there's impact on what we choose to say and what we feel free to say, but that we take personal responsibility for that, again, within the context of these 45 minutes. Related to that also is that we keep, I knew this was not going to be a good place for this, but I didn't want it to be too far away, personal experience. This is really not designed to be about necessarily what we've read, what we've seen, what we've been trained, but our own personal experience with how racism affects ourselves, how we've seen in our own lives how it's affected relationships, how it's affected institutions in which we might work or be related, how we've seen it affected in the broader arena, whatever our experience is. So if somebody's experience is international, that can come into the room, but it's not theoretical, it's not so much in our head, it's based on lived reality. Another thing that I think helps this work, actually I need to get closer to that, is confidentiality. Having said that, I'm not sure it's possible with more than one person in the room. I don't think as human beings we're very good at that. But I think one of the ways that makes it a little safer is not just the kind of standard, what's said in this room stays in this room. I think that's a good rule. But also, what we've come to call here confidentiality times two, that whatever's said here stays here, and it stays among us, but anything of a personal nature, we don't bring up even to each other somewhere else. You know, this, we've got guidelines. This, we've got rules. If I see you 20 minutes, an hour from now, over there with your lentil loaf, with 400 people around, none of these guidelines are necessarily in place, so it may not feel as safe if I say, oh, Nancy, that thing that you said, it was brilliant, and, you're sitting there going, neon lights are on me, let's create a safe space where the conversation stays here and that we don't even bring things up to each other without permission. I think if we use discretion and want to carry on a conversation further, that can happen, but discretion and permission, I think, would be related there. So confidentiality, what's said here stays here, and that we also don't bring things up of a personal nature to each other in ways that aren't necessarily safe. Having said that, I'm hoping that makes it a little freer for us, if not easier, to take some risks with what we share and how we listen to each other and what we say. And then the last one I would suggest is that listening, that we listen, that the listening is at least as important as the speaking. Is there anything missing that would be helpful for any of us in the next?
The only one that we use all the time is keeping it to I statements.
I statements, great. So yeah, personal responsibility and experience, I statements, yeah. Anything else folks would want to add? And we can, if we need something more, we can add to it. Great. Can I ask that we are willing to play by these rules for the next hour or so?
Yeah.
Great. Let's just introduce ourselves and say why we came then. And I'd like to not do the kind of go around the circle. There's a method that Eric Law uses a lot. He's an Episcopalian priest who is also Asian American gay man, who I've been fortunate to do some work with, and he really is invested in multicultural conversation. And part of what he thinks helps make that work is by inviting one another to speak. I think especially across cultural lines of difference, there's different expectations about speaking, whether you speak if you're just empowered in your own culture to speak up, which white people often are. Many cultures don't necessarily have that cultural value, and that you wait out of respect to be invited to speak. And so it sets up that dynamic of invitation. And it's called mutual invitation. So we can practice that. I don't think we'll do the whole time with that, but at least as an introduction, it's kind of a helpful way rather than just kind of ding, 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 ding. It also is helpful because if I start and Nancy knows she's going next, and I'm picking on Nancy because I know her name, and Yvonne, and I don't know your name, so I won't pick on you. you know, she might be listening to me with half an ear, but also thinking, right, what do I want to say? So hopefully it's a way to really focus our listening and then trust that the words will come when they come to us. So let's go ahead and share our name and why we decided to come today. And Yvonne, would you go first?
My name's Yvonne, and I decided to come today as something that I've encountered and had the opportunity to explore a little bit. The first thing that comes to mind is that sort of eye-opening realization of my own unseen racism just as a white person, in this culture. And it was a college class on women writers, one of whom was Alice Walker. And it was a great class. It was very ethnically diverse in that class. And I think it was mostly women. There were some men. But that was just I just still recall just that eye-opening, like, whoa, and the shame, too, because, you know, the ways that we commit acts of racism without even intending to. And I think I still live in a pretty white world, you know, having sort of been given a few of the basic tools in the toolbox, and realizing how hard it is, if you're white, to recognize your own racism. I try to where I can, sort of illuminate that in contexts that are appropriate to sort of pass on that knowledge a little bit. So I thought this was yet another opportunity to add some tools to the toolbox.
Go next.
Okay.
And also, just let me interrupt for a second. You're free to pass anytime you're invited, but then you get to invite somebody as well. So that's always an option.
I'm curious.
My name's Diane Herfor, and I'm from Tacoma. Before I say too much, I have a sticky diaphragm. And so if I start yawning or breathing funny, it's because of my diaphragm, so don't take it personally. I'm not bored with you. But it happens especially after I've eaten something. So, I actually have always worked in a multicultural areas. I was a teacher in the Central City area, became a lactation consultant and labor support for especially women without partners, and then and back to substitute teaching and mostly work in the two schools that are most culturally diverse. And my problem is a little bit the opposite. It's my family is very culturally diverse, and I'm finding that there's prejudice against me just because the kids look at me and see me as that old white lady who obviously doesn't know anything about my being black or Asian or Latino. And I'm getting tired of the comment of, you did that because I'm black, right? And so I'm trying to get some tools to, you know, because I immediately go into the, oh, maybe I am being prejudiced mode instead of, you know, And my new answer lately is, you have no clue what my family looks like. And that stops them dead in their tracks sometimes. But, you know, it's a reverse prejudice that I'm having issues with right now and realizing that that's the issue. So I'm going to see if I can get some tools on that. So, pop over to that.
Thank you. My name is Nancy, and I came to this session because I think I've been troubled by racism sort of in our country and as part of our systems. It was part of my own life for a long time. I work in a very diverse setting, probably in a neighborhood near the ones that you're talking about. The staff of the institution is also very diverse, and the people we serve are very diverse. And so, in a lot of ways, it's a very invigorating environment, because I like being in a setting where people are from many cultures and speak different languages and have a lot of different perspectives. To me, generally speaking, it allows more freedom for everyone to be who they really are, rather than in some little box. But from time to time, there are versions of the same thing that you were mentioning. Well, so-and-so got that special treatment because they're black, because they're not black, or because they're Asian, or they're not Asian, or, you know, or they speak Spanish, or they don't. And then that's always sad. And then I often have reactions kind of like what you were describing too, of, well, you know, maybe I did something wrong or said something wrong, or, well, yeah, this is a racist system after all, or sort of this big burden of responsibility. And then I think, well, now wait a minute. That's not very helpful, for one thing. And there may be other ways to learn to respond. So it's always good, a chance to learn more.
Pardon me?
Oh, Jane, would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, thanks, Nancy.
Always good to have cultural clues, you know.
I'm Jane. And part of why I'm here is it's my privilege to serve the village in multicultural outreach. It's also my challenge to serve an extremely culturally white and demographically white community and try to do multicultural outreach. And so a big part of that I'm committed to, and that I've tried to do in a lot of different ways is to work on my racism and help create space for white people to work on our racism together. This is not an exclusively white group, but it often turns out to be because of the demographics of the village. And it's something that I tried to do in my last job, and it kind of crashed and burned. But I still think, I take it very seriously that racism is predominantly a white problem. We're not the targets of it particularly. I mean, I think there are elements where we get hurt by it too. And I think we're not predominantly the targets, but we are, I think it's, for the most part, our responsibility to try to clean it up. And so that's part of why I do it. And if I can't work on it on a personal level, I'm probably not going to work on it well on a systemic level, even though I think most of the problems are systemic. So that's why I'm here. It's kind of one of those both ands. It's a benefit to my job to be able to do this. Thank you. It sounds like I'm hearing a couple of maybe similar things about how do we respond. I put up some statements as conversation starters if we need them, but I'm also very open to going with the I'd say both the emotional, what comes up for us when we're accused of racist behavior might be a good one, because often that stuff is what gets in our way of having a helpful response. Hey, Carol.
Hi.
But I'm also open to any of those comments as well. Carol, we just introduced ourselves and said why we were here.
Enjoy
and
enjoy this.
Yeah. And so if you'd like to do that too.
Sure. I'm Carolyn Hinderly, and I'm here because I want to hear how Jean lays these out, and I'm very interested in the subject also, and anything that I can learn about communication and not being offensive inadvertently.
Great. I'm glad you're here. These are the ground rules that we agreed to, which I'm not going to go through my whole spiel on that, but basically an assumption of good intent, that when we speak it's good intent. Sometimes even with that, the impact is painful, and so each of us gets the opportunity and has the responsibility, if we choose to say ouch if something inadvertently does, you know, trigger something or hurt. We take personal responsibility for what we do using I statements. We're going to speak from, we've covenanted to speak from personal experience, to make use of what we call here confidentiality times two, which is not only that what's said in this room stays among us, but that we don't come up to one another and bring something up of a personal nature, you know, for example, in the middle of the dining hall, you know, with 400 people around, that we use some discretion and ask permission before referring to things again, even with each other. Hopefully all of those will help us take some risks with each other, and that listening is important. And this is not at all a teaching session, except for the fact that we're all teaching and learning from each other. So it's really a support group model and speaking and sharing with one another from our experiences. So I've heard one, perhaps, request on how to respond, and that you had some interest in that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to?
Which one are you talking about? The last one?
No, I was talking about the two things that both of you brought up.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, of how to respond when you are accused of functioning out of a racist behavior. And in a sense, whether it's true or not.
One of the things that you said, that you felt that this is mostly a white issue, and to me, what I felt that way for many years, mm-hmm. as we went through the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. but now I actually feel that each group has their own prejudice and their own assumptions. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm talking about now. You know, a black young man assumes that because I'm white, mm-hmm. I'm going to be prejudiced, or mm-hmm. he makes use of that mm-hmm. As a way to make me feel guilty mm-hmm. and to get out of whatever kind of situation he thinks that he can get out of because of that. You know, maybe he doesn't have to read the assignment. Maybe he doesn't have to follow the rules within the classroom. And if I call him on it, it's because he's black. And so then it's obviously my fault and my problem.
Are you a teacher?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Latino group that I work with a lot, they use language. You know, the other nationalities that are in the school tend to learn English much sooner than the Latino kids because they stay within community and they like the idea that they can talk about things and deal with things and keep us out. Kind of a thing. So, you know, that's my feeling, is that it's become more everybody's problem and not just a white problem.
I can respond to that because it was my statement, but I'd also be interested in what other folks have to say.
Carolyn?
Yeah.
Can I suggest that we just, for Carol's sake too, if we just all just do our names again? We
sure.
Don't necessarily
good
do
idea.
The whole
good
introduction.
Idea. Yep.
I'll start. I'm Yvonne.
Carolyn.
Carol.
Diane,
Nancy,
and Jane. And Carolyn, you kind of agreed to these guidelines.
Yeah, I really apologize for coming.
That's fine. It's fine. Come when you can. It's good. Did
Anyone want to respond? Otherwise, I'd be happy to.
What was your question or your statement?
Part of what we shared, some of us shared, was why we were here. And part of it for me was that I fundamentally see racism as a white problem. Mm-hmm. And systemically, I do. I think absolutely we are not. White people are not uniquely prejudiced, I don't think. I think prejudice does go beyond that. But I think when I say racism, I tend to mean the power to really keep racist structures in place, which I think whites in America, whites in the United States, are the one group that can do that. And I think my experience with individual experiences of prejudice have often come out of that white reality, mm-hmm. that have come out of a reaction to the fact that that's what the people of color that I've worked with have to deal with every day. Mm-hmm. And so that,
yeah, that's that clarifies the context
in which, mm-hmm.
And also
as a white person, I don't feel like I have the right to speak to another racial group's racism or lack of racism. You know, I don't think that's my right, I guess. Mm-hmm. Other reactions or helpful?
Yeah, let me say a little bit since we had kind of started this mm-hmm. conversation. I know you said that we shouldn't talk about what we've read or learned, but one little thing that I've read,
not in a vacuum,
that helped me understand some things about myself and about the dominant culture in our society was. And I don't even remember the name of the author or the name of the book, but there was a very simple equation in this book saying racism equals prejudice plus power. Mm-hmm. And everyone has prejudice.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And prejudice is almost it's not necessarily even a bad thing. Our brains are almost set up so that we have to distinguish. Mm-hmm. We have to categorize. Mm-hmm. Otherwise we can't think. So, and prejudice is another version of that sort of categorization, mm-hmm. and sometimes false, but the power element,
yeah.
See, that's what makes it able to be really a bad thing and impressive. But I would disagree with you a little bit, Jane, mm-hmm. because, see, I've been in situations where I certainly was the minority person, mm-hmm. and even though in the overarching culture of our country, mm-hmm. White people are certainly in the dominant situation. I think in smaller contexts, mm-hmm. The power shifts. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's possible for someone who's not in the dominant culture to be racist, and actually to have the power in certain settings mm-hmm. to carry that out. Yeah.
I'm not trying to say whether people of color can or can't be racist. I just don't feel like I've got the right as a white person to say that. That's all I'm saying. I have definitely heard stories, especially among various people of color, between Latinos and African Americans, between Asians, and I think I guess I would still say, and maybe it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, that it's the broader context that is white dominant culture still, I think, frames it and may even create the impetus for, in smaller settings where power can be grabbed, that's what's been taught. And I think it's fine to share resources that we've got. This isn't a training, was my point. And I think that may come, one book that I know uses that is a book called Dismantling Racism by Joe Barnes, who is with Crossroads, or used to be, he's retired. Another definition that I've heard is prejudice plus power plus privilege, mm-hmm. Which is often that invisible thing that we don't necessarily know we've got.
But the light kind of clicked on to me too when you said that, because these young black men that are saying this to me are using it as a form of power too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Because that puts power in their court,
yep.
as well.
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts, but related to that, I think that it's important to recognize that there are really different kinds of power. And you're talking about an overarching societal power, which is really important to recognize. But I think that in some ways, to not recognize the power that minorities or people at having that kind of disadvantage, even the disadvantage of a student over against the teacher, not recognizing that kind of power actually diminishes that value. If you just assume the kind of power that you have over against your student, that student doesn't have any bargaining power with you. Mm-hmm. But in not recognizing the power that person has, you know, you eliminate. I mean, what you're doing, I think, I'm just not sure I know what I'm saying here, but you're saying, okay. No, I think, okay, give me a moment. I think in recognizing the power that student is using, you are giving that student an acknowledgement of a kind of humanity or personhood. You're saying, okay, this may be true that I have this situation. Oh, I know. I have to stop right now. I got off the.
Yeah. No, I think I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And you missed the acknowledgement. I'm finally getting to the point of saying when they say you're just doing that because I'm black.
Right.
I immediately would shrivel.
Exactly.
Thinking, am I being prejudiced? Am I not being prejudiced? No. But now, I look the kid directly in the eye and say, you have no idea what my family looks like.
Yeah.
And that stops them. Because my sister-in-law is Japanese, and my adopted brother's Filipino, and we have blacks and Latinos in the extended family. So they don't know what my family looks like. And so that makes them at least stop and think.
Right. And that's
and then it. So I'm speaking to him as a human being,
right,
instead of trying to do the power play thing. Mm-hmm. But I'd like some other tools with that too.
Right.
I can use some other tools.
It seems like you have great resources within your own family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've asked. Well, the black and Latino kids are a little bit too small to be asking those questions yet. But I've asked that question, and their sort of attitude as well. Just consider the source and move on. But sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to. Sometimes I do ignore it because it's just disruptive to the class, and I let it go. But other times, I have to call a spade and deal with that.
And maybe one of the important things is to not allow yourself to be diminished by that
accusation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the hard part.
Right. I know I run a restaurant, and I realize after all these years that since we are in a small, it's not completely a monochromatic town, but it's pretty close to that, so that one notices when an African-American family or person or whatever comes in the door. You notice because it's not usual. And I've learned that I have to take special steps to make sure that person feels welcome. For one thing, they are surrounded by white people. And I have been accused of making distinctions and seating somebody. I mean, I'm numerous, not huge numbers, but it has been explicitly stated to me on occasions that I have been prejudiced in the way I've taken an order or seated someone or all these things. So I mean, maybe it's okay for me to be especially cautious about that, but I don't want to be so cautious that I don't also extend the same sense of hospitality and welcome to that person that I would to someone who looks just like me. You know, so I think it's definitely something that helps us to examine and be aware of. I also have African American family.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah. And you wouldn't know it by looking at you because you're certainly Caucasian. And so,
right.
And that's the thing that I try to get the kids to understand is,
yeah.
Would there be a way to say, huh, that's not what I was intending to do. You still have to do X, Y, and Z. What would be more helpful? You know, just basically still hold them accountable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still expecting X, Y, and Z to get done,
right.
In part because I'm responsible for your education and I want to take that just as seriously as these other kids.
Right.
But help me do that better. What can I do? Because I think there's still the possibility of impact.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was just a way of trying to get out of something, you know, he might, who knows what he'd say.
Right.
But, you know, yeah, we're all saturated with all of the racist messages many of us grew up with. I don't know anybody who didn't, so, you know, I don't know.
Well, my first year of teaching, all of my kids were black except one Caucasian girl. And there were many times when she would be totally crying, why can't I be black? I want to be black. I want to fit in. And, you know, it was real difficult for me to figure out how to deal with this poor child being the only Caucasian.
You know, isolation's always hard.
Your first example about the black kid who was saying, well, they're just making me do this because I'm black. You know, it seems to me that part of what I'm hearing sort of underneath that statement is a lot of fear. I mean, just a fear that in fact, you know, the fear of possibly being singled out for that very reason or for some other reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it just seems like, I think, especially as a kid, I have, well, this isn't a story about racism, but one of my famous stories of my childhood, which I'll make very short, is I had a bad experience with my piano teacher one day, so I didn't practice, and the next time to go to lesson, and I told my mother I wasn't going to piano lessons, and I was six, right? And so her response was just to say, well, fine, you're never, fine. I mean, to my total shock, you know, when I was expecting her to sort of draw it out, well, can you want to tell me why you don't want to go to piano? No, she was like, you're not going to piano, you're not practicing. I'm like, fine. You know, so anyway, just as a child, especially, just there's just many layers of things that are being expressed in one statement, and it's easy to take it at face value, and but that's not necessarily what's.
Well, and that is very true, because I'm talking about black teenage men.
Yeah.
Black teenage boys, I have it rough, because they always have to have to deal with the consciousness of once they're walking down the street, are they going to be perceived as a gang member? Are they going to be perceived as somebody who could be hurtful to somebody in that, and so they do have a heavier burden to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that comes to play as well. But it's hard not to get sucked into their game.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, that's what I think. James' response is a good is a good first step. The thing about power, though, too, is that, I mean, if we're talking just strictly power, you can also have students who become very adept at using whatever, at finding whatever means there might be to avoid that work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to you to find a way through that game, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that there are a lot of steps that we have to be prepared to take just to bring our interactions and our relationships forward to a mutually satisfactory place.
I don't want to dwell on this too much longer, but just one positive note that I was thrilled. I was asked specifically by one of
a black student that I've had over the last 4 years that I really did not expect to ever finish school. You know, I could have bet $100 on the line that he would not finish high school. I found out at graduation he almost didn't because he had to give the principal a book report in order to make it down the aisle. But this past year, I was riding him pretty hard. And the reason why, I pulled him aside and I told him, I said, you might think I put my, you know, bang an egg on you and that I don't like you, but the whole thing is that I am so proud of how you have come along in the last 4 years. And to tell you the truth, I didn't think you'd make it. And he looked at me and he said, to tell you the truth, I didn't think I would either. Mm-hmm. And he says, you and my grandma were the only ones who believed that I could do it. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to make sure I was at graduation. Mm-hmm. When I walked in the door, he gave me a huge bear hug because he was so excited. I'm sure he's probably the first person who's ever graduated in his family. Mm-hmm. So.
I'm changing the subject slightly, and I'm just curious, you know, you mentioned how this is, as a predominantly white, middle, upper class kind of place, it's hard to, you know, explore racism deeply, but I'm wondering if there are incidences of it here, or, I mean, aside from...
Sure, all the time.
Yeah. I mean, and are they sort of along the lines of, you know, oops, or are they more, you know, intentional? Probably both.
Yeah, I think both. I'm aware of both.
Yeah.
Most of what I'm aware of is the unintentional.
Yeah.
The one that I can't see as anything but intentional was last week.
Right.
We did a training called Uncomfortable Neighbors with the editor of the Spanish paper for Washington State, and he's Anglo, and his wife is
Latina.
She was born in the United States, but is Latina, and it was just a wonderful training on kind of the cultural collisions between Anglos and Latinos. And when we came in for the second morning, there was a very derogatory phrase written on the whiteboard that they were using in Spanish. One of the worst things you could possibly say. And there it was. And we have no idea who said it. We have no idea why it was there, but it was just, you know, it couldn't have been just, oh, I'm trying to learn how to write Spanish. It's not one of those, you know, hi, my name is. It was, it's,
or somebody accidentally wrote one letter wrong.
No. Yeah, no. It was, and,
It was funny because my Spanish is so minor. And I remember walking in and seeing that phrase on the whiteboard and thinking, oh, I wonder what that means.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear about it till later that it, in fact, it was because I think, I don't know, I wouldn't have sat there for the whole time.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I had been able to read that. So.
Yeah. Well, and just even the way that we handled it was interesting because we handled it in a very Anglo fashion. We had learned kind of the day before that the whole I'm sorry thing that white people do a lot is not necessarily how a Latino would do it. That it would be, well, I wasn't here on time because I got stuck in traffic and I did this and I did that, which I would take it as an excuse, but that's the way, that's the apology. But Diane felt that it was extremely important to make a public apology at both lunches and say, you know, how harmful that was, which I think, again, in a predominantly Anglo culture, that was helpful. But I don't know that necessarily Jim and Rosa Maria, you know, felt that it was all that necessary. But Diane did, and she took responsibility for it.
But see, I think that this was an incident of hurt to the whole community.
Absolutely, and that was,
not just
it absolutely
to the
was.
People, yep. Although certainly to them primarily.
Yep. Yep.
That was interesting, wasn't it, that someone who knew Spanish well enough to have written it in Spanish would have been offended or whatever by whatever.
Yeah, well, and it's, yeah, I mean, what sparked it, we're not sure. Although one of the things that Harry said to me later is, he said, you know, I don't know much Spanish, and most of the people that I know from Yakima don't know much Spanish, but they would know how to write that phrase. If it's just one of those things that the first thing you learn, if you're in cultures that clash, is how to diss each other.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. So I was assuming that it was fun, someone who knew a lot of Spanish too.
And it would probably be true in Eastern Washington, where there is a more of a clash.
Right. Right. Or something that. But in terms of racism at Holden, I mean, part of, I think, what my position has been for, and what some people who have made use of it for, are the few, especially staff who are of color, trying to be a safe person that they can come to and talk about those things. And some have made use of that and some haven't, but that is, I think, part of the role as well.
What was interesting about last week's session was recognizing that cultural differences and just not understanding each other's cultures feeds the racism.
Absolutely.
And and it's just, you can't help it. I mean,
you have to very intentionally.
We have to work on that. But yeah. I see where the line gets fuzzy between cultural differences and racism, because the cultural differences often come with a different skin color and a different language, and so it all gets. But I'm very interested in trying to become more aware of those unintentional faux pas, you know, just based on a cultural assumption that, well, this is of course how the way you do things, and if you do it differently, then you're just plain wrong,
Let me give you an example of a bad mistake that I made. That I should.
This is a great place for confessions.
I should have known this would not be a good idea. And it relates to this idea of getting to know a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Two of the cultural groups that I work with a lot are Cambodian and Vietnamese. And when I first started working with Southeast Asian people, I knew almost nothing about their history, culture, anything. But I learned that Cambodian and Vietnamese people have a history of great enmity, and that Vietnam had invaded Cambodia at times. And I also learned that their cultures are very different, even though they're immediately bordering each other. Cambodian culture tends more towards the Indian culture and the East, and if you look at their letters, they look more like the lettering of Indian languages. And Vietnamese is somewhat more Western looking, at least among the people that I knew. So anyway, knowing that there's this long-standing history of enmity between these two cultures. One time I was planning a panel, which ironically I think was on something like multicultural approaches to something or other. And I had a Vietnamese man and a Cambodian man sit next to each other. They should have never done that. And they were both very polite. Mm-hmm. They didn't say anything, because of course I was the person in authority, and they were going to, you know, do what the person in authority said to do. Oh, afterwards I realized they did not want to sit next to each other. Comfortable.
How did you become aware of that?
Well, because they both pushed their chairs about as far away from each other as they could. And they both looked out and they didn't, you know, engage, interact at all. And by that time, of course, it was too late, but I thought, oh, I made a mistake.
That's easy to do with that. Because, you know, my sister-in-law, as I said, is Japanese, but she's very tall for a Japanese. And so a lot of people think she's Korean. And the thing that she thought was the funniest is when she went to Japan, she can't speak much Japanese at all because she was born in Hawaii. And so they don't see her as a Japanese woman. Mm-hmm. And they were wondering if she was Korean or Chinese or something else, you know. And we see Asians as sort of all looking alike kind of a thing. And
So it's real hard sometimes when you have a Vietnamese Cambodian. So I've come close to making that kind of a mistake myself. Yeah. That's
cool. I think those are some of the things that make it hard for me as a white person to work on my racism, because mm-hmm. I think I have to be perfect. I think I should get this all right. And once I allow myself the freedom to make mistakes and admit that I'm going to, it gets a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course I'm going to.
Nothing
and it's like the harder I try not to make mistakes, the more the wrong thing comes out of my mouth.
Yeah. It just reminds me, I think it's helpful to realize that in a similar situation, they might make a mistake too. And so we can't beat ourselves up too much.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm thinking of is my sister, who is, we're all German heritage, but everyone else in the family got the Southern Germany darker looks, and she's a blue-eyed blonde. But she married an Afro-American and was married to him for 13 years. And Peter is, if he has any other mix in him, it doesn't show. It's very dark. And I grew up in rural Nebraska. And I don't know if any of you remember that movie, Luck Who's Coming to Dinner. But we had a real Luck Who's Coming to Dinner because my sister brought him home for the first time without anybody knowing that she was coming, and ended up through a plane delay getting there at 2 a.m. in the morning to rural Nebraska, where I think I may have been in at least high school before I ever saw a black. I mean, it was just no one ever in the community. And Peter was very open about racial problems and so on, and was very critical of whites. And if he had drunk something to fortify himself, then he would really let it out anyway. And one of the things I remember he was critical of, that whites never distinguished. You know, they'd say, oh, they all look the same.
Yeah.
And he was so critical of that. And then one evening, because when they were visiting Nebraska once, he happened to be looking at some slides I was showing to the family of Papua New Guinea, where I had been teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this slide of this whole group of students there. And, you know, just without, Peter just said, well, he said, how did you tell them apart? They all look the same to me. And then just a moment
just
later, it kind of dawned on him.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say, you know, it can happen to others too, and they can be understanding. We can't always be too hard if we're trying.
Yeah.
But we make some of those mistakes.
And that shows what a difference experience makes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And understanding.
Because I wouldn't have even been able to make the distinction
mm-hmm.
between the Vietnamese gentleman mm-hmm. and the Cambodian gentleman mm-hmm. when I first began the work.
Right.
I wouldn't have seen the differences.
Right.
And of course, then as soon as you think you learn the differences,
right.
then you
yeah.
find examples where you know those categories don't actually work after all.
Yeah.
But I had the same experience in having more real direct life experience working with black people.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I honestly did not distinguish very much among people mm-hmm. because they kind of all looked alike to me. But as I got to know people and got to know them as individuals, then the distinctions were immense. And I thought, Nancy, how could you ever think that those people looked alike when they're so different from each other? But my eyes had to learn, my mind had to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a relatively new context for me, as might have been the situation with you when you first got to know your students in Papua New Guinea. Maybe
and later
you didn't see the distinctions as clearly at first.
Very definite, because later on, even though they were black, mentally, if I didn't know their name because it was a village or something. But I would give them a name of someone they reminded me of who was a white person.
Ah, yes.
You know, they would,
When you mentioned not being too hard on yourself and, you know, not trying to be perfect, I think maybe self-humor can be one of the best things.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even admitting how stupid we are about each
mm-hmm.
other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, because, I don't know, because in a situation where we're really different from the person we're meeting, and there's an anxiety on either side. But I think if we can just admit right out that things that we, you know, I mean, carefully, of course, but things that we don't understand, you know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I mean, there's even a level, I mean, which cultural words change, you know, we've gone from black to Afro-American to, you know, I mean, now, and
you started with nigger.
But Negro was an acceptable
Negro,
not,
I mean,
a
Negro.
Bad word.
I say it started with Negro.
Right. And then it became a bad word. And now I've heard it again in some context. But
and
being part of the dominant
some
culture,
people have preferred, I mean, if you talk to African American people,
right.
Some prefer to be called black.
Yeah.
Some prefer to be called African American.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Some say they would really rather be called Afro American.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot of personal preference that you
right.
have no way of knowing until
right.
you know the person.
Well, exactly, and I think that points to the best method, better than any training I've known, is relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, but that also puts me back into more training and more reading and
sure.
more all of that.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
You know, anything that I think can help build relationship, and that's where you can make mistakes and go, oh my gosh, what did I say, and have that forgiveness and reconciliation and that kind of thing. But if there isn't a relationship, none of that's possible.
Yeah.
One of my fun experiences that put me in my place was when I had my first class, and this was in the 60s, and Martin Luther King was, you know, going strong, and Cassius Clay at the time was becoming really dominant, and the kids were really excited about him. And sat at a Sunday school thing with all my white neighbor parishioners and trying to explain how he was and is a great influence on young men and should be honored instead of feared. And it was at the time he became Muhammad Ali, and people were concerned that he was going to do this horrible brainwashing of all the black young men and the, all of this. And so I really got on my high horse, and I was just ranting and raving, you know, and you guys don't understand, kind of a thing. And my minister, who was Harold Sigmar, if you knew him, he just very quietly said, you know, I have a prejudice. And I looked at him, he's the most unprejudiced person I knew. He says, I'm very prejudiced against people who are prejudiced. And I kind of slumped down into my chair. And I thought, oh, well, I guess I am a prejudiced person. So I always try to keep that in mind. That you can get, you know, you can go off into the opposite direction and think that you've got it all solved and you're perfect. And
no question. Do we have time now?
Yeah, I need to go on because I'm supposed to be at a rehearsal. But I believe you can be in the room until dinner time for sure. I think there's a session at 6:20 in here probably. But
I think that's right, 6:20.
Yeah. But feel free to stay. Looks like a couple folks have joined us upstairs. I don't know if you want to try to join in the conversation from up there, but a couple of folks listening in. Just would encourage folks to remember confidentiality. And thank you for being here. Feel free to continue.
Thank you.
And I'll finish cleaning up the
room. My question for you is there a place, and this may apply to any of you who are really a teacher of many black students. Is there a place for you to address them or help them to come to an understanding of how they're, what they can do for themselves to break down the barriers between themselves and them, just for their own self, for their own benefit? Because I think that, I mean, there's a certain awkwardness that in situations where people are aware of their differences but don't speak of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the person in the dominant culture, by bringing up the difference, can be very offensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember a couple of situations I've been in where in an attempt to be disarming or to disarm, I've called attention to a difference that that person may not have wanted to have acknowledged.
Right.
And one of them was in my master's interview. Anyway, that's a whole story. But I think that is there a way in which your students can understand that if they open that up, or if they're comfortable in acknowledging the difference, that they can sometimes break down a barrier that might benefit. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think
it's hard, but I mean, for just in order to help equip them to live in a culture that is.
The only thing I can say is that I think it happens, but not in the classroom at Lincoln. This one, Lincoln High School, is the one I'm the most familiar with. And in that particular school, there is no majority.
Right.
There is quite a balance between all of the different race and cultures. At times, we've had a principal who's helped with celebrating that diversity really well. At times, we haven't. But they often will have, like on Martin Luther King holiday celebration, they'll have a program and to celebrate the diversity and the different cultures in there. And one year, especially, they had to dance for each culture, and including a Caucasian what's the name of it? Right, they're just dancing around. It's a 20s kind of a dance. Anyway, but they celebrate every single culture with a dance and that. And there was enough teachers and enough students of each culture to really make it work. And the thing that was so wonderful is there was an autistic boy that hardly ever spoke, period, who sang the national anthem. Mm-hmm. And this was shortly after 9/11 and that. And he did have some problems getting through the national anthem, but when he stopped and he got a little scared, the entire school applauded him. And only as the black community can, the amens and come on and you're doing great. And he got through it and they cheered him, and tears were streaming down my face because they all were working so well together. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't always happen in the classroom. It happens, I think, more in the hallways and that. And this is when we were starting a program, small schools, and Bill Gates is giving a lot of money for scholarships. And one of the kids came back who had gotten a Gates scholarship, and he said he didn't realize how isolated he was being at Lincoln, because he was so used to the diversity. Then he went up to the University of Washington, and everybody goes, because you're black, you should know about this, and you should know about that, and you know about this and that because you're black. And he's going, no.
Yeah.
And that's when he realized that his minority status much more than when he was at Lincoln. So I think it's happening very slowly in our culture with the kids, and that's why I keep thinking that's our answer.
What I'm just going to say, it's hard too, because sometimes it's very real and sometimes it's a perception, because it has been so real in the past.
Yeah.
And right now we have a really hard situation for us to think of what's always right in working with a woman who was born in Eritrea, but who became a refugee in Sudan with her family, then eventually was sent to Lebanon, and then eventually married a Somali who became abusive. And so anyway, so she's eventually ended up in Minneapolis, a single woman who's now divorced from this abusive Somali husband with now, she's been there a year, but now she has a one-year-old, a two-year-old, and a four-year-old, very limited English, and of course needs tons of help and support. But we're always making not so much mistakes, but just that we're always having these cultural clashes. Because, for instance, in her culture, you didn't have a family doctor. Someone's sick, you go to the emergency at a hospital. You know, that's just like, that's just where you go, to the hospital. And so she wants for everything that one kid will get, and then all three of them, you know, picks up from whatever, to go to the emergency, just like this, when you know the doctor's going to say, give some Tylenol, you know, Dick, and which she's already had for the one beforehand. But her then perception is, or her paranoia is, that in fact once she even told the translator that someone who was really trying to help, but you know, you can't, nobody has a car unit can put three car seats and get her to an emergency. But we didn't want to help her, wasn't speaking to me personally, but those of us trying, the person who was helping her, because we were trying to save money to send her to the Somalis, because she's so down in the Somalis now because of this abusive Somali husband. And so she turned against the translator, decided she was a bad woman, thought she was translating wrong and telling the doctor to tell her she didn't really need these things, that it wasn't anything that bad. And you know, it just snowballs, because the more she needs help, the more she turns against.
Have you read the book, Spirit Catches You? And
yes, yes, wonderful. And I just wanted to check with you, is it Lincoln, Nebraska?
No, Lincoln High School in Tacoma, Washington.
Oh, when you said Lincoln, I thought possibly Lincoln, Nebraska. Yeah. Have you ever read the book In the Middle of Nowhere?
No.
Heard about that book.
Lincoln, Nebraska used to be called the middle of everywhere. It used to be called the middle of nowhere.
Uh-huh.
She now calls it the middle of everywhere because they have 40 different languages represented in the school.
Oh, wow.
But it's an excellent book.
Yeah.
And it's on the culture.
Come on in.